From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, two unique performers. First, comic Sarah Silverman. Her routine might sound racist, sexist, or homophobic, but only if you aren't listening carefully. Her concert film, Jesus is Magic, is about to come out on DVD. Also, the late Tiny Tim. His two claims to fame were the 1968 hit Tiptoe Through the Tulips and marrying Miss Vicky on The Tonight Show. There's a new collection of his recordings called God Bless Tiny Tim. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new documentary The War Tapes, compiled from footage shot by soldiers on duty in Iraq. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. If you were only half listening, you might think that comic Sarah Silverman was just a little bit racist and just a little bit clueless. But if you're really listening, you're likely to laugh out loud at how she skewers racism, anti-Semitism, and stereotyping. A recent New Yorker profile said, quote, "Silverman crosses boundaries that would not occur to most people even to have. The more innocent and oblivious her delivery, the more outrageous her commentary becomes," unquote. Rolling Stone and Entertainment Weekly have called her the funniest woman in America. She was featured in the comedy documentary The Aristocrats and appeared in the films School of Rock and There's Something About Mary. Terry spoke with her last year, following the release of her stand-up concert movie Jesus is Magic, which will be released next week on DVD. Before we hear their conversation, here's an excerpt from the film.
Like, I don't want to be labeled as straight or labeled as gay. You know, I just want people to look at me and see me, you know, as white. And, you know, that sounds... I can say that, by the way, because I used to go out with a guy who was half black who totally broke up with me because I'm a f***ing loser. And, I just heard myself say that. So I'm such a pessimist. I have the worst attitude. He's half white, and he totally broke up with me. And it's funny now, like what is it? Hindsight's 20/20 or whatever. Like, I know it's so obvious to me now why he broke up with me, you know, because he has low self-esteem, you know, and I can't compete with that. Like, everybody knows somebody who, it's like anything you say to them, they're gonna take it, they're gonna hear it in the most negative way. You know what I mean? And he was like, you could give him a I gave him a compliment, all right? I told him he probably would have made like a really expensive slave in the olden timey days, not now. And what does he do, right? It goes through the Rube Goldberg, you know, crazy straw of his low self-esteem, and it hit his ear, and he heard something, you know? I can't control that. Like, I can't control what he hears, you know? He has to learn how to love himself, you know, before I can stop hating his people, you know? As a people. I don't care if you think I'm racist. I just want you to think I'm thin.
Sarah Silverman, welcome to Fresh Air. I think your movie is really funny. I'm wondering how often people think that you're genuinely racist or homophobic or anti-Semitic or whatever.
Not often. It doesn't happen often, but it certainly happens. I mean, probably more often than the average person. But, yeah, I have an old boyfriend who would call it mouthful of blood laughs. Where their audience is just completely laughing at the wrong thing, not understanding any of the irony or, you know.
You got in trouble with one Asian American media watchdog group. The head of that group didn't like you using the five-letter word that starts with CH. It's just a derogatory word to describe Asians. So you use that on Conan O'Brien, I think it was?
Yeah.
So what happened?
It was simply a joke about racism. I had to say the most racist word I could say on television. And, you know, they said, well, could you say Jew instead? And I thought, maybe dirty Jew would be like I could. But it wasn't good enough because I'm Jewish and it becomes self-deprecation and it had to be racist. And it was the whole point of the joke. And anyone who heard it, for the most part, understood that there is a context to it. And
so what was the thing what was the bit of your act that started the controversy?
Joke, yeah. The whole crazy joke is this. I got a notice in the mail to do jury duty, and I really didn't want to do jury duty. And you have to fill out this whole form and then send it in, and then you're randomly chosen. And I did not want to do jury duty. And a friend of mine said, you know, why don't you just write something really racist on the form? Like, I hate chinks. And I thought to myself, yeah, you know, but I don't want people to think I'm racist. I just want to get out of jury duty, you know. So I wrote, I filled out the form and I wrote, I love chinks.
Well, that's funny. And it's a joke. I mean, it's a joke all about racism and you don't get it.
Your clearly, I'm the ignoramus.
Exactly,
yeah.
You're the ignoramus. Yeah, yeah. So the protest did not get you to rethink your humor. You're just sorry.
No,
that...
I mean, I dropped the joke because I ended up having to say it so many times and on Politically Incorrect and stuff like that. It just became old news, you know. But no, I mean, it was a reaction to a buzzword with no context even being considered, you know. So I can't, you know, even trying to defend it just implies guilt of some sort, you know.
In your act, you talk about having been a bedwetter until you were about 15. This is a very embarrassing thing to talk about. Why go there?
Well, I don't know. I guess I grew up really believing that this would be the deepest, darkest secret of my life, you know. You never think as a child who's a bedwetter that you would ever tell anyone, ever, you know. And then you grow up and it's, you know, it becomes just a part of your life and a part of what makes you, a part of what informs who you are, you know. And, there's a certain amount of pride and there's a certain amount of, you know, some, I'm sure, unhealthy need to expose myself, you know. And I mean that literally. But also, you know, there's something about it that feels good, you know.
Now, a lot of our listeners probably saw you in the movie The Aristocrats, which is a documentary about how different people tell a joke that's basically the premise of a joke, and then each comic who tells it kind of does these really obscene riffs on the premise. Have you always been comfortable speaking that blue in front of people?
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm one of those kids that, you know, my dad thought it was, like, really hilarious to teach me swear words as a toddler. And it's funny, you know, I think that I would say them and the reaction I would get would be so fantastic that I think it, I searched for more and more and more, you know, and I was kind of farmed that way, you know. My parents, you know, my dad swears, he's the sweetest man, but he... It's just a part of his language. It's like, you know, or totally, but it's the F word.
So is it supposed to be really cute for a little toddler or a kid to be using words that we can't say on the radio?
Apparently in the 70s, it was adorable. Adorable. So because of that, I think I've had this kind of comfort with, at least with language. I don't even think of myself that I don't swear particularly a lot, but just raised in a family that was, didn't have maybe the same spectrum of boundaries. It was bigger, you know, the wider. I'm not a oddball in my family. We're all freaks in that way, you know. So I think that I was always kind of comfortable saying that. I think the race stuff was stuff I was not comfortable with until my 20s, you know, because I, you know, for all the right reasons, you know, if someone said something racial, even in a joking way, it upset me. I remember a friend of mine who was a comic put a nickel on his forehead and said, "Hey, look, Jewish Ash Wednesday." You know, he's Jewish, you know. He said, "Jewish Ash Wednesday." And, of course, today I would, you know, it's hilarious. But I was, like, 19, you know, I just started doing stand-up, maybe even 20, and I would get so upset. And it's funny how I've changed, you know. And maybe because of that, you know, it, I was so affected by race and stereotypes that I kind of, even though it was never mine to begin with, I think I kind of took it back. You know what I mean? Like a take back the night, but the night was never mine.
Well, were you exposed to a lot of racism or anti-Semitism as a kid?
No.
There was a lot of it in your neighborhood?
I have no license. I have no license to be doing what I'm doing. I didn't grow up in an all-black neighborhood or something. I'm not black myself. I grew up a Jew where there were no other Jews. But the only thing I can remember from my life is, like, in third grade, a kid on the bus threw, like, pennies at my feet and said, you know, pick them up, Jew, like, you're a cheap Jew or something like that. But it was so innocent, you know what I mean? It's a kid doing it. And, of course, I didn't have that perspective then, but at the same token, he became my little third-grade boyfriend probably a month later.
Oh, really? Did you even get what? Did you even get it then? What?
Yeah, I did. I was like, yeah, Jews are cheap, ha, ha, ha. I don't know. You know, I was raised in a place where there wasn't, you know, people weren't racist. I mean, it was a time in, you know, the 80s or whatever, where in a world that was very white and there were no Jews, but I didn't feel threatened at all. So even when that happened, I was just kind of like, it's weird. You know, I don't know. But, you know, my dad grew up in a very different world. You know, he was beaten up and abused brutally, you know, for being Jewish.
Did he tell you stories about that when you were young?
Yeah. Yeah, he was sent to a prep school. You know, his parents did well, you know, but it was some sort of Christian prep school, wasn't. And, or it was just not, there were not Jews there. And kids would, like, encircle him, you know, and call him, you know, kike, dirty Jew, all that kind of stuff, and beat him up. And, you know, this was in New England, either, it must have been New Hampshire, I think, by then, and they would go have ski teams or whatever, and one time they were all bullying him on the snow, and he stabbed a guy in the stomach with his ski pole.
Yikes.
Yeah, and got suspended for it, of course. But, you know, it's so sad. You know, you want to kill those kids. My small experience with racism was just in a time where it didn't threaten me in any way. I wasn't in a world where it was threatening. But, you know, when I hear the stories that my dad tells, it's so heartbreaking.
Sarah Silverman speaking with Terry Gross. Her concert film, Jesus is Magic, will be released next week on DVD. We'll hear more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with comic Sarah Silverman.
Now, one question about your father. Your father used to own the Junior Deb Varsity Shops. Did he just own a couple of, in a franchise of them?
Yeah, it was a small chain of boys and girls clothing that his father owned. And then he sold them and kind of retired so that he could write, because his real passion is writing. And wrote some novels. And then ran out of money. I had to open a store again, and opened a store called Crazy Sophie's Factory Outlet, a discount women's clothing store. And he did his own ads on the radio.
No,
and they're hilarious.
Oh, really?
Well, he's got this really thick Boston accent. I mean, you can really hardly understand a word he's saying. And he'd be like, this is Crazy Donald, Crazy Sophie's husband. It's a made-up name, though. He'd say, when I see the prices at the mall, I just want to vomit. Come to Crazy Sophie's. We got Unicorn Wrangler, this, that, all these like kinds of jeans you've never heard of. And then at the end he says, so if you care enough to buy the very best, but you're too cheap, come to Crazy Sophie's.
That's really funny.
Yeah. And then on the other side of the spectrum is my mom, who's from Connecticut and speaks perfectly and says, you know, things like when and where. And she went to the local movie theater and complained that she could not understand what the person was saying when she called up to find out what movies were playing on the recording. And they said, oh, you want to do it? And she was like, okay. So I grew up with her, you know, going with her to the movie theater and to the little booth where they kept all the not fresh popcorn. And she would say, hi, and thank you for calling Bedford Mall Cinemas. 1, 2, 3, and 4 were all bargain matinees. Are only $2 Monday through Saturday. So
well, that's great.
Different. Yeah, showbiz family, yeah.
Neve said that you think most comics are filled with self-loathing. Does that describe how you felt about yourself when you were young?
No. No, I didn't. I had a, I've always had a pretty healthy self-esteem, you know? I mean, I think I'm sure I'm riddled with insecurity as well, but I like myself. I've got a pretty good self-esteem. I think, like, my comedy came more from humiliation and from, you know, I say it in the movie, but it's kind of true. It's like I was a chronic bedwetter. You know, I had this deep, dark secret. You know, if I had to go to sleepover parties, I would, like, just pinch myself awake all night. You know, I was, you know, the one thing about being Jewish and the thing that made me feel the most Jewish, because we weren't religious in any way, was that I was so friggin' hairy compared to these, you know, Carol Reed, L.L. Bean, blonde Aryans that I lived with, you know. So there was that kind of, you know, you want to be funny. You want to be funny before anyone is funny on your behalf, you know. Or, you know, one time I have Elvis Presley's death to thank for a party in first grade, a sleepover party at Heather Paul's house. And for some reason, I had no sleepover clothes. I had to borrow her pajamas. I slept, you know, in a sleeping bag, soaking wet the next morning. And just kind of paralyzed with fear, didn't say anything or do anything, and changed with the other girls, you know, changed into my regular clothes and just left the clothes kind of on the floor there. And her mother came in. She was so mean. And she stepped on my pajamas and she was like, who did this? And I was just, my heart was just pounding. I was so scared. And right then her husband came in and said, Elvis Presley just died. Thank God.
Do you think that being a woman stood in your way at all when you were starting out? Because I think of, I don't really make the round of the comedy clubs, but I think of a lot of the comedy clubs as having a lot of, and this might be completely coming out of ignorance, but having a lot of male comics who make a lot of jokes about women and sex and that.
No, because I think you make jokes about what you're thinking about and your life experience, and that never affected me or bothered me. I made jokes, you know. I lost my virginity as a comedian, so my act became all about sex for a while, you know, because it's just all you're thinking about, you know. And I think I never really felt like a woman. I mean, there are individual little stories and snags that there was frustration. And I'm sure in the beginning, you know, like I play basketball, you know. I used to play a lot more, and I know that kind of feeling. It's just like being a woman comic and having to prove yourself with a new set of peers, you know, where you like go to the YMCA for a pickup game, and those first couple games, it's that anxiety of having to prove that you can that you play hard, you know. And I think that it can be that way with being a woman in comedy or anything where the majority of people in that field are male, you know. Nobody's doing anything wrong. It's just human nature. But I've only ever been a woman in stand-up or in life at all. And so I have nothing really to compare it to. It's been quite a ride. No, it's been fine for me.
Sarah Silverman, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Silverman speaking with Terry Gross. A DVD of her concert film Jesus is Magic will be released next week. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. From Picture House, presenting the Robert Altman film A Prairie Home Companion, with a cast that includes Woody Harrelson, Lindsay Lohan, and Meryl Streep, opening June 9th. And from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Let's get back to Terry's interview and concert with the late Tiny Tim, recorded in 1996. A box set of three albums he recorded in the late 60s has just been released.
Your big breakthrough in terms of celebrity was your recording of Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
Yes.
In fact, why don't we hear a little bit of it?
Tiptoe through the wind. With me, oh, tiptoe from the garden, by the garden of the willow tree, and tiptoe through the tulips with me.
You know, I think in the business you're seen as a novelty act. Is that how you would like to be seen?
Maybe not. But if it's so, fine. Because I wanted to make it. And I prayed, of course, the right way. And if that's the cross I have to bear, fine. In fact, I want to emphasize, in case many articles say, I'm not trying to change by doing this album. I like the songs, whatever's top 10. I have a heavy metal record in Sydney, Australia, with Highway to Hell, which I did in 1993, which never even came out to this country yet. I've done the song because I like the song. Youth makes all music. Youth made ragtime in 1910 when they were saying, bring back the old songs then, like I Love You Truly. And youth made jazz in the 20s, right after World War I, and the boogie-woogie in the 40s, you know, and the rock and roll in the 50s after the blacks originally did it. So I'm telling you, so youth makes their own music. So when I see these old-timers say, oh, what disgusting music it is, they haven't heard it. The rap and the beats and the soul are the music of this generation, and one has to be born again into these songs. That when I did Highway to Hell, just a snip of I'm on the highway to hell, living easy, living free, season ticket on a one-way ride. No, and that's with a heavy metal band. So definitely one must take and be born again into this new music today. Just, if I may do one more for you.
Oh, please.
Miss Terry. Yeah, this is a, now we just left Decoration Day. And there was another great song, ironically sung by Henry Burr, for the great veterans who died on Decoration Day, to remember them. In 1917, this great song. At a grand old meeting on Decoration Day, I heard a veteran proudly say, "What makes us love this country, land of the brave and free? I'll tell you what," said he, "it's liberty. L stands for love of our country, I for independence too, B for the brave men who fought for us, E the emblem dear at white and blue, R for the right that we fight for, T true Americans will be, Y is for you and for your country too, that stands for liberty."
You certainly put your heart and soul into songs when you sing them.
Oh, listen, there are great romantic songs going back, you know, especially from 1848 and Stephen Foster's time to about 45. The great melodies in the gramophone years, so many like that, which I have listened to and which have consoled me in this business. It wasn't the loss of fame or never seeing the cash that got me. It was the broken hearts that I've suffered many years over romances due to my excitabilities or my simplicities that were broken up, and I couldn't get them back together again. You're so patient, Miss Terry. Just let me do one more number from that period that I sing many times when I think about some women I've hurt with too much of a hasty argument and I've never seen them again. This was written in 1916 by the late, great Ernest R. Ball and J. Karen Brennan, who wrote When Irish Eyes Are Smiling and Mother McCree. Also sung by Harry McDonough, great star. Just a snip, and thanks for your patience. Turn back the universe and bring me yesterday. Turn back the hands of time that hold life's golden ray. Take back that bitter hour when our love passed away. Turn back the universe and give me yesterday. Many a time I was singing, take back that bitter hour when our love passed away. I have experienced that many times in romances, and I've experienced that in 1985. I was working with the circus then, third-rate circus, Alan C. Hill Circus, going from town to town. And I came to a place in New Jersey where I worked, or Pennsylvania, and they allowed me a night off to, right after the circus, to go to a new disco opening up in New York called the Palladium. There was a beautiful girl, Miss Lauren, there. She was I was so much in love with her. She was only 19 years old, and she liked me very much. I'll never forget that great night. But a few years later, about 88 or 89, I had some argument with her, and even though she's had arguments with other people, it was a shock coming out of this mouth, and nothing was the same after that. That's one incident. I wish I could take back that bitter hour when our love passed away. And to all your listeners, it is true. One word, one gesture can break up a romance.
You know, everybody's getting rid of their turntables and putting in CD players instead. I bet you still have a lot of 78s, right?
Not anymore, but I tell you, since you brought this up, I am the only, if I may say, celebrity entertainer who has at least one or two cylinders in the Edison Museum in Bellard, Illinois, since 1977, if it's still there. At that time, I recorded with my late conductor on the piano, Marvin Lewis, two Edison cylinders from the machine. They were nice out there to to cut, you know, the old, they shave off the old cylinders for 2 minutes to sing some of the great, one or two great songs of 1904. And this is how I sound it through the cylinder horn. Nothing to do, Nelly darling, nothing to do, you say. Let's take a trip down memory ship, back to the bygone days, back to the old village schoolhouse, back to the dear days of yore. Let's take a trip down memory ship, let us go there once more. School days, dear old golden rule days, reading and writing and arithmetic, taught to the tune of a hickory stick. You are my queen in calico, I was your bashful barefoot beau, and you wrote on my slate, I love you, Joe, when we were a couple of kids.
Tiny Tim, and what other performer would want to sound like that were really recorded in 1904, and what other performer would know the verse to School Days?
Well, a lot. Well, remember that great song written by Gus Edwards in this country was the biggest cylinder record at its time, and when recorded on the old Columbia 78 at that time, which was only one side, it was worn out. And this whole world went to this great singer, Byron G. Harlan, and the song School Days, still played somewhere today, you know, in some place around the world. I mean, these are great melodies. I call this the white man's soul. I know you heard of the black man's soul with rhythm and blues and ragtime, but this is the white man's soul. These great melodies like You're a Grand Old Flag, like Yankee Doodle Dandy, School Days, In the Shade of the Old Apple Tree, they moved. They moved the hearts of men, women, children. It was not the words alone, but the music had a spiritual uplift. And that's what makes popular music, the, in my opinion, the root of all music.
Tiny Tim, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, Ms. Terry Gross, thanks for being a good listener, and it's a pleasure talking to you and your Fresh Air fun.
The late Tiny Tim, recorded in 1996. A box set of three albums he recorded in the late 60s has just been released. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the War Tapes. This is Fresh Air.
Got dough and oh ho ho, there ain't no paint on the bungalow. What of it? We love it. We wear old clothes.
Coming up, the late Tiny Tim, the eccentric singer who was immersed in the pop music of earlier eras. His recording Tiptoe Through the Tulips became a hit in 1968. The CD box God Bless Tiny Tim collects his recordings. And David Edelstein reviews the new documentary, The War Tapes.
At 9 p.m. we lock the door, we've got each other and nothing more. What of it? And lots of happiness. Sunshine or rain, we don't complain. If we ain't got more, we do on less. Oh, we bought a car and how it squeaks. A dollar down every 7 weeks. What of it?
We love it. We hang our wash upon a tree. The neighbors give it the raspberry. What of it?
We love it. Our next door neighbors are the biggest hearted souls, and they don't holler when they miss the milk and rolls. Milk and rolls.
We write our checks in white and black. We send them out, but they bounce right back. What of it?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross.
My dear friends, I want you to listen to the chorus of this song, and on the second time around, gather all your friends and neighbors and join in. Let them sing.
There's a light shining bright in a little cabin window down Virginia way. And they say every night when the night shadows fall, Mother's light through the night seemed to call to her wandering son. When his wandering is done, please come home to stay. For a light still burns in a little cabin window down Virginia way. Down Virginia way.
That is, of course, Tiny Tim. Most people who remember Tiny Tim write him off as an eccentric one-hit wonder. The hit was Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which he warbled in his falsetto voice, accompanying himself on the ukulele. But he had a great passion and knowledge about the music of earlier eras. Radio host Barry Hanson, otherwise known as Dr. Demento, was a champion of Tiny Tim. He wrote, "How ironic that Tiny Tim should be a one-hit wonder, seeing as he was a man of 1,000 songs. Make that 10,000. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of American popular music from the 1880s to the 1950s, and could sing most anything you asked for right on the spot, with a perfect feel for the song, the era it came from, and the singers who sang it back then." That's from an essay included in the new box set God Bless Tiny Tim, featuring the three albums Tiny Tim recorded for Reprise Records in the late 60s. It's just been released in a limited edition by Rhino Records. Tiny Tim died on stage of heart failure in 1996. He was 64 years old. Just a few months before his death, he recorded this interview and performance on Fresh Air.
Tiny Tim, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good afternoon, Ms. Terry Gross. It's glad to speak to you and your wonderful show.
Now, let me play a song from the new CD that's more in your period. More, I guess this is a turn-of-the-century song. And it's called Sly Cigarette. Tell me about this song, how you found it.
Well, that was my darling wife, Miss Sue's favorite. The song was sung in 1898 by S.H. Dudley, one of the great cylinder stars of his day. I got this in a collection of cassette tapes from Mr. Dulo, a great historian who passed away a few years ago in Florida. And I thought the song was another great melody and also a message song. Even though it was 1898, it was a shock to see a woman smoking.
Let's hear Sly Cigarette. And this is Tiny Tim from his new album, Girl.
Oh, you poor little cigarette. How they're stomping and crushing you today. They're taking advantage of your small little nature. They're blaming you for cancer when you can still get cholesterol from butter and fat from lard and bacon and all these meats and cheeses that are causing heart attacks and tumors. Why are they picking on you, oh sly cigarette? It's not fair. Somebody has to protest and get back to normality again. When I have to pretend, but I don't, you know. Oh, sly cigarette, yes. Oh, fine cigarette, what is it? Why did you teach me to love you so? When I have to pretend that I don't, you know.
And my guest is Tiny Tim. So tell me, do you sing in a falsetto anymore?
Yes, right now, it's in the afternoon. This needs a lot of warm-up. I'll just see if I can even do a poor version of... Oh, tiptoe through the tulips with me.
And how did you discover your falsetto voice?
Well, I thank Jesus Christ for every gift, because I really prayed about it one day. And about 1952, I needed something... to differentiate myself from better singers at the time, especially from Tony Bennett, Perry Como, Guy Mitchell. And so every entertainer, every artist, every comedian, every broadcaster should have a sound, an originality in the voice that the mass can identify with singly. And so originality is the key to success. You can close your eyes and know it's Louis Armstrong, know it's Bing Crosby, and the same thing, you know, it's Tiny Tim if I do tiptoe, whatever. And so that's what I looked for, that's what I got, and from 54 on, it proved to be successful.
Now, back in the 50s, before you were famous, how did you dress when you performed?
Another good question. Well, I had a usual shirt and tie and suit jacket. I didn't start wearing costumes until, 68, 69, and Mr. Sharp in Australia made me unbelievable costumes after that. But when you went to amateur nights, you always had a suit and tie on.
Short hair?
Yeah, until 54. Then everything changed. Not only did the hair become long, which I took a little bit from Rudolph Valentino. Mr. Valentino, in his book that he wrote in 1923, and he had his hair parted one way over the eyebrow. I wanted mine the other way. And the only difference is that while long hair was here since day one, the difference here is that I had white-faced makeup with it throughout the day. Not just for show business. And the white face, whatever Jolson did to blackface, it happened here with white face and the long hair. So that in 1954 and 55 and 56, in the years that President Eisenhower was here and the McCarthy hearings were ending, I mean, that was a rough thing to look at 24 hours a day.
You said you were wearing the white makeup not just for show business. What were the other reasons?
Another good question, Ms. Gross. First of all, since I was not good-looking and I didn't want to cut this nose off, I was afraid of operations, I've always wanted to appeal to certain type of women I liked. Everyone has their dreams of what they want. And, of course, the hair was too short. So when I wore the makeup, I should also state that I still cleanse today about 8 to 12 times a day and use night creams and eye creams and throat creams and, of course, light makeup. But at that time, I wanted to also appeal to the women, even if they said, oh, I can't stand them. Look at that ugly thing in the subway trains. At least they were paying attention. So part of it was for show business, and part of it was to live within myself and be content. And it started to work on both fronts. On the amateur nights, I was starting to win under Larry Love in the 50s, and in the subway trains around the neighborhood, they were all looking. And the high voice also became, believe it or not, appealing to especially the girls who listened to me. Whether it was funny or grotesque, it still was appealing. At least they paid attention. And so that's the difference.
Excuse this cheap bit of psychoanalysis.
Right ahead.
But it seems to me, in a way, what you're saying is that you felt unattractive, you felt like a freak, and so to transcend that, you kind of turned yourself into a freak by putting on makeup and growing your hair long.
I was unattractive. I didn't think I was. I was a very ugly person when it came to looks.
Mm-hmm.
They looked at it as a freak, you know, with the white makeup. And mm-hmm. The world looked mm-hmm. at it that way. The world looked at the hair like that, and especially in the 50s, the middle 50s. But inside one's heart, I felt that I was especially wearing white makeup, not dark makeup, because white seemed, I've always looked at the princesses that I adored in my dreams to be equal with the white light, beautiful springtime. And I wanted to feel within me, with the songs and everything, that I had a sensuality with the women I liked. I don't know if I can explain it that way. And by wearing this light makeup, I felt even with myself by keeping clean. I've always looked at women as clean objects who wash their hands all the time with soap, who take care of their bodies and never offend.
So the white makeup gave you a sense of purity and cleanliness.
Beautifully put, beautifully analyzed, yes.
Do you still wear it?
Well, it's not as white as it is, but it's whitish today.
Tiny Tim recorded in 1996. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you. down below, down below.
In 2003, Deborah Scranton declined an offer from the New Hampshire National Guard to be an embedded journalist in Iraq. Instead, the former TV reporter trained soldiers themselves to be cinematographers and kept in touch with them by email. The result, The War Tapes, won the Best Documentary Prize at this year's Tribeca Film Festival. Film critic David Edelstein, who was a member of that jury, has a review.
In the 60s, the critic Michael Arlen called Vietnam the living room war because TV brought the bloodshed into people's homes. But even with today's small light cameras, TV reporters in Iraq have been hamstrung when it comes to getting close to the action, first by government restrictions on their movements, then by the escalating danger of being kidnapped or blown up by roadside bombs. The director Deborah Scranton found a way around the problem in 2004. With the approval of the National Guard, she supplied several guardsmen stationed in Iraq with mini DVD cameras, along with tripods to mount them on vehicles. The upshot, The War Tapes, is among the most revelatory documentaries of the Iraq War years. This isn't raw cinema verite. Scranton and her team edited more than 1,000 hours of tape down to a taut hour and a half. And the film's 96-minute running time includes interviews with family and friends back home. Yet the movie gives you a sense both of the dread of waiting for the violence to erupt and the panic of actual engagement. Although several guardsmen sent back footage, Scranton focuses on just three. Sergeant Steve Pink is a carpenter and an aspiring writer.
Every once in a while, as we're driving down the road, creeping along on patrol, I have a reoccurring epiphany. This is happening and will have a lasting impact on me for the rest of my life. A debate we had earlier in the day over the consistency and texture of a severed limb was not some far-off grotesque assumption. It was a genuine argument between the guy who swears it resembles hamburger, ground up but uncooked, and the guy who believes it looks more like a raw pot roast. There is no argument, however, that human intestines are pink pork sausage links, if, of course, you imagine a butcher's block as the background instead of the screaming, then soon quietly moaning casualty.
The second subject, Specialist Mike Moriarty, is a gung-ho patriot who cites September 11th and the lives of his kids as reasons for going to Iraq, and who sometimes mouths nukem platitudes to stay revved up, even when confronted by Iraqi police instead of insurgents.
Come on, because I dare you to shoot just once. Oh, thank you.
Keep going, brother. You want to play? They're shooting at me. I don't give a f*** if they're the Pope.
Sergeant Zach Bazzi is the more inscrutable specimen, a Lebanese-American whose doting mother brought him to the U.S. from what was, she says, the worst place on earth, and who enlisted to go to another as soon as he came of age. She can't understand it, and neither can he fully. There's little talk about why the Americans are in Iraq, only that, according to Zach, they've been taught next to nothing about the culture of the people whose country they occupy. The War Tapes portrays day-to-day life in a world without a compass. A soldier carves a wooden pistol because he's not allowed to carry a real one. Guardsmen express irritation with Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown & Root, which runs all the American stores and charges hefty amounts for paper plates of bad food. We don't see anyone hit by bullets, but the camera is on the fringes when a convoy comes upon an IED, an improvised explosive device.
Are we on fire?
IED! 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 Get rid of that! IED! IED! Go, go!
Yes! Let's go! Look for a target!
Because of the Geneva Convention, the only footage the director couldn't show was of the dead insurgents from that battle. but we see plenty of bodies of civilians. In the film's most haunting scene, the camera surveys pieces of a young woman who made the mistake of crossing a road on which American trucks barrel recklessly along. A soldier says he watched helpless as she was knocked unconscious by one truck and then turned into, well, it looked to me like hamburger. But that description isn't his. He's weeping that his people have just killed someone they were sent there to protect. When the three guardsmen return to the U.S., Scranton just scratches the surface of the scars they bear, in part out of respect for men who revealed so much already, in part because not a lot needs to be said. The war tapes make the case not that war is hell, but that this war is a corrosive mixture of hell and purgatory, with carnage so random and ubiquitous, it would be laughably absurd if it weren't so tragic.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Snakeskin Shamisen, a Maserai mystery by Naomi Hirahara, author of Gasa Gasa Girl. From Judy and Steve Hopkins, supporting the Shakespeare Theater's production of Pericles, May 25th through June 4th, at the Carter Baron Amphitheater, Washington, D.C. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress C.C.H. Pounder. She was raised in British Guiana, schooled in Britain, and got her start playing drug-addled crime victims on U.S. TV. Now she's the new captain on the testosterone-driven FX TV show, The Shield. Join us for the next Fresh Air.